Herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast in der Reihe Zeitbühne. Mein Name ist Roman Blätter, ich bin stellvertretender Leiter des Wirtschaftsressorts der Zeit und moderiere diesen Podcast, in dem wir Gespräche von Zeitredakteurinnen und Redakteuren mit Gästen aus Politik, Wirtschaft und Kultur präsentieren. Heute hören wir die Laudatio von Christine Lagarde, der Präsidentin der Europäischen Zentralbank, auf die EU-Kommissarin Margrethe Vestager anlässlich der Verleihung des Marion-Dönhoff-Preises für internationale Verständigung und Versöhnung an Margrethe Vestager. Der Preis wird seit 18 Jahren alljährlich von der Zeit, der Zeitstiftung Ebelin und mit Gerd Bucerius und der Marion-Dönhoff-Stiftung vergeben. Diese Preisverleihung fand am 6. Dezember 2020 statt, wegen der Corona-Pandemie erstmals digital im Livestream. Der an Vestager verliehene Dönhoff-Preis ist mit 20.000 Euro dotiert. Der ebenfalls mit 20.000 Euro dotierte Förderpreis ging an die Non-Profit-Organisation Viva Con Agua, die sich für einen sicheren Zugang zu sauberem Trinkwasser und sanitärer Grundversorgung einsetzt. In ihrer Laudatio würdigt Christine Lagarde unter anderem Margrethe Vestagers Vorbildrolle für Frauen und dass sie zeige, dass es falsch sei, wenn Frauen Männer kopieren wollen. Im Anschluss erklärt Margrethe Vestager im Gespräch mit meiner Kollegin Iliana Grabitz, die das Politikressort von Zeit Online leitet, warum die seit Jahrhunderten geltende informelle Männerquote ein guter Grund sei, Frauenquoten einzuführen. Aber hören Sie selbst.
Guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren. Ich darf Sie begrüßen zu der diesjährigen Verleihung des Marion-Gräfin-Dönhoff-Preises. Mein Name ist Iliana Grabitz. Ich bin Politikchefin bei Zeit Online in Berlin und ich freue mich sehr, Sie heute durch den ersten Teil dieser Veranstaltung führen zu dürfen. Bereits zum 18. Mal vergeben die Zeit-Stiftung und die Marion-Dönhoff-Stiftung diesen für uns sehr wichtigen Preis, der dazu dient, das geistige Erbe von Marion-Gräfin Dönhoff zu bewahren. Sie war eine überzeugte Europäerin, der die Verständigung und Versöhnung zwischen den Völkern sehr am Herzen lag. Jahrelang, viele von Ihnen wissen das, fand diese Verleihung im Hamburger Schauspielhaus statt. Dieses Mal ist wegen der Corona-Pandemie alles anders, wie so vieles anders ist. Und so vergeben wir den Preis in diesem Jahr das erste Mal komplett digital. Ich spreche zu Ihnen von einem Studio im ehemaligen Luftschutzbunker am Hamburger Heilig-Geist-Feld aus. Und von hier aus begeben wir uns auf eine kleine Reise. Zunächst nach Frankfurt zur Europäischen Zentralbank, wo unsere Laudatorin Christine Lagarde zugeschaltet wird. Und danach nach Kopenhagen, wo unsere Preisträgerin Margrethe Vestager auf uns wartet. Wir freuen uns, wenn Sie uns von zu Hause auf diesem kleinen Europatrip begleiten und diesen besonderen Moment mit uns teilen. An dieser Stelle noch einmal ein herzliches Willkommen an alle, die uns jetzt zuschauen von draußen. Ich freue mich nun sehr, das Wort an Christine Lagarde übergeben zu dürfen, an die Präsidentin der Europäischen Zentralbank. Frau Lagarde wird die Laudatio erhalten auf die Trägerin des Hauptpreises, Margrethe Vestager, die wir gerade in dem schönen Film gesehen haben. Margrethe Vestager ist die Vizepräsidentin der EU-Kommission und EU-Kommissarin für Wettbewerb. A warm welcome to you, President Lagarde. We are so happy having you here today. And I don't want to waste many more words now. Stage is all yours.
Well, thank you so much. Let's go straight into this laudatio, because I'm very, very pleased to do that for your paper. And for the prize, and particularly for Margaret. So, Madam Vice President, dear Margaret, Chair and members of the jury, Margaret, it is a pleasure to give this speech in your honor today as you receive this year's Marion Dönhoff Prize. We did a bit of research, clearly. And when I think about the parallels between you and Marion Gräfin Dönhoff, whom we duly remember with this award, one thing is in particular stands out. It is this deep sense of social responsibility you both have in common. Now, that impulse took you into politics and Marion into journalism. But both of you, in your own ways, went on to shake and wake up our societies. And in thinking about your contribution to Europe over the years, I'm also reminded of the words of your compatriot, the Danish philosopher Kierkegaard, who wrote, and I quote, "The greatest hazard of all is losing one's self. And that can occur very quietly in the world, as if it were nothing at all. No other loss can occur so quietly. Any other loss is sure to be noticed." And in many ways, what you have done since you joined the Commission is to stop us from quietly losing ourselves. You have defended our values and our laws at a time when they could otherwise have been chipped away by new monopolies or new technologies. Now, I think of you with three attributes that led you to take three kinds of actions that have had impact. One, you courageously enforce our rules. Two, no matter the size of the opponent, you empower people in a fast-changing digital world. And three, you encourage individuals, men and women, but especially women, to be the best they can be, but more importantly, to be themselves. So, Margaret the Enforcer, I think it hardly needs recalling that you are one of the most, if not the most, famous antitrust enforcers in the world. Celebrated, including by some strange tweets. But your reputation as a fearless regulator did not come about by chance. When you took over your portfolio, you inherited a long list of pending cases. And one by one, you took them on with fresh eyes, a curious mind, and as you once said yourself, in the firm belief that democracies, not businesses, should set the direction for our societies. Margaret, I vividly remember a conversation we had at that time. Competition might at first glance seem like a technical issue, but fundamentally, it is about who accesses and holds power in the economy. A competitive market is one where smaller firms are free to challenge larger ones, where barriers to entry are not that high, and where consumers are free to choose from a rich variety of goods and services with an informed and fair choice. So, unfazed by power and influence, you began filing charges against the world's biggest technology companies for breaching European state aid, merger and antitrust rules, ordering them to pay billions in back taxes and fines. The dynamic between you and the so-called tech giants reminded some of the biblical story of David and Goliath. I'm not sure it's the right comparison, but at least as a daughter of two Lutheran ministers in the Danish People's Church, you will appreciate. But perhaps it's a little misleading, because in reality, you are never the weak partner. Through the strength of your character, you harness the European Union's huge regulatory power to protect and enforce its values, building this very new bridge between competition rules and tax rules. As you said about your move from being a legislator in Denmark to a regulator at the European Commission, we put a lot of effort into creating new legislation, but too little effort into implementation. It takes a lot of political leadership to implement, because that's when it changes. Moving on to Margaret the Empowerer. In your role as Executive Vice President, you have the responsibility within the Commission to set the strategic direction for a Europe fit for the digital age. Well, while digitalization brings many benefits, we know that it can also create issues related to data protection and invasion of privacy. And this can lead to a sense of being manipulated a sense of powerlessness. If people fear that their personal data is being used in an opaque way. Indeed, a survey conducted in 2019 shows that 62% of Europeans are concerned that they do not have complete control over the personal data provided online. And such concerns are only likely to grow as our economies become more dependent on digital services. You've been very alive to these challenges and acted to ensure that a more digital economy supports rather than undermines our values of transparency, democracy, and privacy. In particular, the Digital Services Act package, which you are going to propose soon, I know, aims to give us more control over our choices online, more transparency about how our data are used, and more protection against their misuse. In this way, it is an act of empowerment that will be made available to all of us. So thank you for doing that. Moving on to the third Margaret, Margaret the Encourager. That's what I would like to highlight today. You encourage others. Not by artificial devices, simply by being yourself. By using the power of authenticity, you have given so much encouragement to those coming with you, behind you, men and women, but especially women. For a long time now, you have set an example for others to follow and for women to be inspired. You joined politics in party politics. Not the easiest one. And you run for parliament at the age of just 21, going on to serve as your country's deputy prime minister. In fact, I'm told by my Danish friends that you embodied Danish politics so much that you were the inspiration for the lead character in the hit political TV series, Borgen. You'll have to tell us. You have also come to embody a type of female leadership that is inspiring many of us. It's a leadership that goes beyond stereotypes about male and female qualities, but instead focuses on women actually finding their own confidence and their true voice as individuals. You recently spoke about how women need to overcome the fear that you're not right if you're not male. You noted that women will never be accepted if they try to copy men. I've said that myself many times too. So what do they have to do? They have to take the much harder route instead, to be themselves. As a woman who has also spent her career and her life trying to encourage others, I take great joy in this. The role model that you are providing in your current position, thriving, leading, inspiring others, is the best case we can make for why the world needs diverse leadership. Margaret, Europe is blessed to have you, and men and women are lucky to be able to learn from you. So coming back to Kierkegaard, I trust that with you at the helm, we will not lose ourselves as we transition into the digital age. That's what I really wish. Congratulations to you. Bravo, Margaret. I'm going to now hand over the prize to you digitally, as was indicated. And this is the Marion Donhoff Press 2022 to Margaret Versager.
Thanks a lot, President Lagarde, for your kind words for our award winner, Margarete Vestager. That was a wonderful speech, and I really liked the concept of the three Margarets you outlined. And I'm sure we will have the opportunity to speak about all that with Margarete Vestager later on. I send my greetings out to Frankfurt now and wish you the very best. Thank you so much, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We now switch over to Copenhagen, where I will have the opportunity to talk to the prize winner herself, Margarete Vestager. Hello, Mrs. Vestager. A warm welcome to you, too. It's a big joy having you here today, this morning. And first of all, my warmest congratulations go out to you for being awarded with the Margarete Marion Dönhoff Prize 2020. How are you doing?
Well, I'm here with you. And after such a speech by Christine Lagarde and with the Marion Dönhoff Prize, I don't think I possibly could be any better. It is such an honor. I'm really, really happy to be here with you.
Well, Mrs. Vestager, it's a couple of weeks ago that you learned that you were actually going to win the Marion Dönhoff Prize. What was your first reaction when you learned that you were going to be awarded? What did you think?
Well, the biggest thing that one can achieve, in my opinion, is to stand on the shoulders of those who came before you. And what Marion Dönhoff did as a journalist, as a freedom fighter, is truly inspiring in these days, because these fights are not over. For journalism to be able to do their job, for each and every one of us to have, you know, the full respect and the integrity as citizen in our society. So to be allowed into that family is an honor I never expected.
Okay. So, Mrs. Vestager, now let's use the time to dive directly into the European politics, right? I think all the people who are watching us now are very interested in your thoughts about Europe in this really challenging situation that we have in this year. Let's start with a personal question. You are a convinced European. We have seen that in the film before. And I was wondering, did you have a moment of awakening, so to say, as a European? Was there a certain situation when you realized, hey, I might be Danish, but I'm a European woman in the first place, and I want to fight and live for this idea?
Well, I was quite young. And probably my countrymen will not appreciate this, when I realized that my country is lovely and strong and beautiful, but quite small. And if we are ever going to live out our ambitions, if we're ever going to influence anything, it's because we work with other people. And that was a thing I realized in my, I think before I turned 20, and having traveled a lot in Europe and listened to the different languages, enjoying different cultures, different kitchens, that sort of built it as part of my identity.
So for people of our generation, Mrs. Vestager, we actually were growing up with the idea that the EU actually only knew one direction, which is growing bigger and bigger. But back in 2016, we had to learn that there is also the opposite tendency, the opposite movement. Great Britain is about to leave the EU, and every now and then we see other countries sympathizing with this idea too. So do you think it's possible that in the distant future, the EU will either be a lot smaller or will even fall apart?
I think when I was younger, I thought that there was only one direction, and that my generation would merely be sort of consolidating. And I was wrong, because we are still fighting. We are still in a process of creating a Europe that really comes together. And if we fail, then you are right, there is a risk of a smaller European Union and things not delivering to each and every citizen. If we think that we are just consolidating, we are dead wrong, because we need to be much more precise. This is the time where we defined what Europe is and what it should do for each and every one of us.
So, however, this getting bigger is quite a difficult topic, as we see at the moment, right? Because the bigger the EU gets, the more diverse it becomes as well. So we can observe this actually for the time being with Poland and Hungary, who are blocking the EU budget and the Corona package because they reject efforts to tie the spending to the rule of law. Does the EU need more, generally speaking, does the EU need more tolerance for diverse values, or should we stick in any situation strictly to its principles, even if it means running the risk that Europe might be falling apart?
We have both. We have some fundamentals where we should never waver. the rule of law is in itself the basics of any society for the to underline the integrity of the and the dignity of the individual. And only on that basis that we all share can we build real diversity. Because only if we accept that each and every one has the same value and the same dignity and right to be here is diversity the next thing to do. So the two things are completely interlinked. Diversity depend on something that we agree on. And the most important thing here is rule of law and democracy and the integrity of the individual.
So to make it concrete, like for Marion Gräfin Dönhoff, Poland actually was the topic of her life, right? Especially the reconciliation between Poland and Germany. And I'd say till nowadays, a good neighboring is crucial for both our countries. What could be our message to Poland in the conflict over the rule of law now? Do you see any possibility for a compromise?
I think there's always a possibility for compromise as long as we don't waver on the fundamentals. And Poland is so many different things. It's a diverse, strong, multifaceted country. And I think it's important to talk with all these different facets of the Polish society. Because Poland is, of course, as any country, more than its government. It is also something very fundamental. I myself find it one of the best things that Poland is a central country within the European Union. And I'm sure that we can move this forward, but we can only do that by reconfirming that we have this common look upon the fundamentals. Otherwise, it will be very difficult to see the Union as something where you are a full member with everything that comes with it.
But you said that a compromise is possible, right? Could you make it a little bit more concrete? What could a compromise concerning the conflict about the rule of law look like?
Well, of course, it's difficult for me to say because it's not my sort of first-hand responsibility. But one of the things that I very often see in my own work is that people say, okay, fair enough with the rules, but we want to make sure that they are enforced in a proper manner. We want to have transparency when it comes to due diligence, when it comes to the right to defend ourselves, when it comes to the processes, because the rules in themselves, fine, we understand that. But we need to be able to defend ourselves. We need to know what is going to happen, what are the processes. And if we have failed to do that, well, that may be one of the avenues.
Mm-hmm. And as we've heard this week, the EU Commission is now checking options for starting the Corona package without Poland and Hungary, right? And but at the same time, we have to see that the population is going to suffer. I mean, they need these helps desperately. So I was wondering, like, what's your personal view? To what extent shall we prioritize our principles and values over the suffering of people? I mean, this is Europe. Where is the European idea? Where are the limits of the European idea in this case? What would you say?
Well, it will be difficult for everyone. If we need to have a provisional budget, if we should do our recovery and resilience fund with 25 instead of 27, there will be a price to pay for everyone. It's not easy. It is doable, and we will defend this, and we will be able to do it, but it will not be easy. But I think this is the time where we say, well, there are something that we need to secure. And that has been the history of Europe, you know, decades and decades, centuries and centuries ago, that people have fought for the fundamentals to make sure that it is something that you feel in everyday life. And I think it's important that we do that now and that we are willing to say, well, some of the fundamentals, they are important. This was why the wall came down. This was why Europe enlarged. This is why we have been fighting wars in different parts of the world. It is because of these fundamentals.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to look a little bit into the future, Mrs. Vestager. Like Europe, everybody of us has had a very difficult year due to the pandemic, right? But now, for the first time, there is a perspective. We are going to have a vaccine, and that means that Corona might be hopefully under control soon. What will the EU look like after the pandemic? Will there be more solidarity, do you think, or will we have even a deeper division?
I see solidarity developing. We had these awful weeks in March where borders came to a close, where trucks were lining up, you know, queues 20, 40 kilometers, export bans. And the Commission and my colleagues, we don't have much competence here. But reaching out, calling for coordination, step by step, it changed. So that not only has each and every state in each member state a different role today, but also the member states among each other, they have a different role. And I think this is actually deeper than any convention with treaty changes and new institutional relationships, because this is about health. This is about jobs, that we are getting to know each other on a deeper level and coordinating with each other because of the substance that is at stake. And I think that is actually something that will create a stronger Europe, because we will remember this, because we have learned it in our democratic body, not only in the head, so to speak.
I would now like to move on to the second Margrethe Vestager Christine Lagarde was talking before about, and the one who is fighting against the big tech giants, right? As we have also seen in the film before, you as a commissioner of competition have the reputation of being the ice lady, right? You got the ice lady, being the first one actually who worldwide dared to take on tech giants like Amazon, Facebook and Google, and you force them to pay hefty fines. Ice lady, I mean, that's a strong word. Is that how you view yourself as well? And can you understand that people see you as such? I was wondering.
I think it's something that comes with the job. And it's also something that comes being a woman in the job. I think if a man had done the same thing, people would say, oh, he's very sort of resolute and he has a strong hand in his leadership. And that is, I think that shows that we still have quite some way to go before we see male and female leadership without having, I think, some prejudice when it's a woman who has the leadership responsibility.
One of your major achievements, Mrs. Vestager, was the 13 billion tax fine against Apple, right? This summer, however, it was annulled by the European Court of Justice, but you have appealed to Apple's tax case again, arguing that the General Court made mistakes. What makes you optimistic that Apple will have to pay the 13 billion in the end?
These are always difficult cases. The first thing you want to do when you open such a case is just to close it again, because it's so complex. You say, oh, I have a life, I don't want to deal with this. But the thing is, when you then dig in, when you understand in full, and when you also then see what are actually the simple structures here, then you build the case. And we always, no matter what case it is, have the quality control that this should be able to stand up in court. Of course, it was a huge defeat that we lost in the general court. But as I said, we still think that we have a strong case. And of course, we hope that the ECJ will see it from our side or with our facts. Remains to be seen, of course. But as I said, we do the best we can when we find that one company has had a selective advantage that is not available to anyone else. And anyone else, you know, a lot of hard work comes into making a profit. From that profit, you pay your taxes, you create jobs, you take upon young people to learn the trade that you do. And they, I think all these businesses, they need to see that if someone gets a selective advantage, then it's our job to be there and find out.
It's so admirable what you have achieved on the European basis, right? But these big companies like Amazon, Facebook, and Google, and so on and so forth, they are global companies, often global networks. So we actually know that Europe won't be able to tame them alone. So looking back at the past 5 years, you could not count on the United States very well because there was Donald Trump sitting in the White House. But now from January onwards, we will have Joe Biden as the new US president. And I was wondering, what do you expect from Joe Biden regarding the regulation of the big tech giants?
Now they have a big Google case. And the Federal Trade Commission is considering the relations that Facebook has with the market. The U.S. have changed a lot over these 6 years when I have been the commissioner of competition, where I have followed this very closely. And we are reaching out to the Americans under the leadership of Ursula von der Leyen, our president. We have reached out to say we should, of course, deal with the pandemic first. Climate change, and then all the digital issues. There will be, I think, robust discussions, but I think we will also meet a different kind of partnership on what should be the framework for artificial intelligence, so that, for instance, you're not discriminated against in a hiring situation if AI is being used. And how could we make sure that markets are kept open? Because one of the things I see, and I admire my colleagues who were, you know, chef de file of GDPR, of our citizens' digital rights, that they have inspired all over the planet. And of course, even though we do things in order to make the European market work, well, maybe we can also inspire while we do that.
And in terms of the overall transatlantic relations that have suffered a lot lately, like, what are your expectations again towards Joe Biden? And like, do you think that the transatlantic relations will return to what they've been before Donald Trump, maybe to the Obama era?
Well, I think they can be better because we have changed. Not only have they changed in the US, we have changed as well. I think Europe is more assertive. We know more about ourselves and what we can do and what we want to do. I think we can be a much better partner for the US because we are more self-reliant. And two self-reliant, strong partners can achieve, I think, great things. But it's not the same Europe as it were in the Obama times. It is a changed Europe, and I think it's changed for the better. Because I think it's a good thing that we now know much more what we want to do and what we want to be able to do ourselves.
Can you make that a little bit more concrete? You say that we are better now and that the relationships can change, really. What do you think of? What field of politics? Where will we act differently? Where do you want to see another, a more self-confident Europe?
Well, I'll take my own field. Now, we are building up capacity to do really, really super, super fast computers as a common capacity, 8 of them. We have a project to develop microprocessors that will be better to use because they don't use so much energy, so you can fight climate change. We are doing next generation of batteries for our homes, for our cars, to use less material to make sure that we can recycle them in better ways. So we are doing much more on our own. And last but not least, we will develop our marketplace so that every business have a fair chance of making it and not just being in the hands of gatekeepers setting their own rules. So just within digitization, we do things that gives Europe a stronger profile and that makes us more self-reliant while still being this open, amazing continent where a lot of our prosperity comes from our openness.
And talking about a new European self-confidence, right? If we think of the field of digitalization, up to now, like the United States have been very strong. They have very big tech companies and China also. And Europe, there was the feeling kind of had lost track, right? What needs to happen if we wanted to achieve that the next Silicon Valley might be actually based in Europe instead of in the United States or in China?
We should learn from our mistakes. I think there is a reason why there is no big European social media companies. Because we have the platforms, we have the social media, we have the music streaming, but they haven't really scaled up. And what we didn't do was to provide a real digital single market. We didn't provide for a capital market that was dynamic and also came with the competence of businesses scaling up. Now we have built also a real digital single market. We're in the process of building a single market for data. The framework for a real dynamic capital market is there. But most importantly, in Europe, you find the industrial culture, the engineering culture, the tradition for entrepreneurship. This business-to-business culture, I think that is our strongest asset if we can provide the things that we failed to provide and that made us lose out on the first big, big wave of digitization.
And what does it need in concrete? Like what do we have to change in order to build up on that?
Well, we need to want to share our data and to do that in secure manners. And we have shown just recently with the Data Governance Act how that is doable. We need to encourage also investors to invest in technology within Europe. And we need to get the skills ourselves to encourage, in particular, women to get also very high level ICT skills in order to be able to recruit the people that you need and to get a more diverse tech community. So everyone can be part of this. We can educate ourselves throughout our lives. We can inspire young people. Everyone can be part of this transition and make sure that it is a transition with us as humans in the center.
So what you have just said is actually the perfect keyword for moving on to the third Margaret Vestager, the one who is empowering people and especially women, which I think is very admirable, really. Actually, regarding the empowerment of women, we in Europe, I think, have achieved quite a lot, right? Nowadays, there are plenty of powerful women also around you, thinking of Ursula von der Leyen, Angela Merkel, Christine Lagarde, and also the EU Commission has almost reached parity. What would you think? How has politics changed since there are so many women around?
Well, it has not happened by itself. If it had not been for Ursula and her insisting, we would not have been a gender-balanced commission. It doesn't happen without actions being taken. And the thing is, in order really to get there, I think it's important to realize that this is a development where men and women should do this together. Because it also gives so many more opportunities for men to be much more diverse and not just to be, you know, shuffled into certain roles, but to be able to be as different as we are, women between women, but also men between men. Because only when we take action, this will change. Otherwise, we'll have to wait, I don't know, 200 plus years before we have equal pay, before we have gender balance, before we really have tapped into the talent pool of both genders. So there's still a lot to do in order to make a better society.
And I wanted to know, like, what would you think, how has the style of politics changed, you know, since there are so many women around? I mean, when you started in politics, I'm sure there were mostly men around you and you were maybe one of very few women doing politics. So what would you say, how has politics changed, have politics changed in comparison with, well, 10 years ago or 20 years ago?
Yes, I think it has changed. Just the fact that it looks differently. You know, I'm here in a woolen dress, not with a tie, not with a pearl necklace, not with sort of the female version of the male suit. So we look differently. I think it's easier for voters to mirror themselves, to see that those of us who have the privilege of exercising power to reach our goals, that we look more like everyone else. And in that respect, I think slowly but surely, politics becomes more open. And the distance between those who hold power and those who give it, that distance becomes smaller when politics becomes more diverse.
But that's all true. I do see that as well. But we also, looking at all these good dynamics, right? We also see a certain backlash, maybe. Looking at Germany, for example, we have had Merkel for so many years as a chancellor. But regarding the next federal elections, there aren't too many female candidates, right, in the run for chancellorship yet. So what can we do? What do we need to do in order to keep up the dynamic of female empowerment in politics?
Well, two things. First, to stop looking for men, because women are quite poor at being men. So if you're fundamentally still looking for men, then women will not really match the description for obvious reasons. So we have to stop looking for men and sort of for the male ideal of leadership and the deep voice and all that comes with it, and sort of enlarge our vision of what leadership looks like. And then, of course, as women, to say, well, I may not tick all the boxes, but that doesn't matter. I will give it a shot. I think I can do it.
And what about all the men who are then waiting for making career if we now focus everything on women?
But you should never wait to make a career. You should, because this is not something that is a given because you're a man. Also, men will have to figure out how to find my way. But this is only a question of fairness. You know, there has been de facto informal male quotas for centuries of 95 to 98%. I think men should just be happy with the sort of the 50-50. Instead of us insisting on at least 70% for the next 100 years.
So we have seen, or we all know, that there is still quite a way to go, right? Still we have parity regarding men and women in politics and even more in economics, actually, like in the economy. So would you say that in the economy we need a women quota?
Well, as said, since I have realized that the informal male quota works so very, very well, that has told me that quotas will work. And you have so many gifted women. The question again, do you see them? Or are you still looking for a man? And then, of course, then women will fall short of that description. Because also now within finance, you see more women having the necessary qualifications in order to be able to do the job. And I think it is for any leader to make sure that both men and women are being nurtured and trained in order to take leadership positions. Also, when it comes to, you know, being the CFO, because very often that is the stepping stone to be the CEO. So there is a huge responsibility on my generation in order to make this happen. It is not just for young people to do something. No, it is for my generation and older generations to encourage this, to change how we see power, how we see talent.
May I ask you a personal question again? Many women's careers end because they get to the so to say glass ceiling, right? Did you ever experience yourself that you ended up at a glass ceiling at any stage in your career?
Well, I might have, but I don't think I ever realized, because I never sort of planned a career. Now I want that step and that step and that step. I just kept open for what may come. And then I've always figured, what is the worst thing that can happen? Very often in my position, the worst thing that can happen is that you lose an election. And then that really hurts. It hurts your vanity, but you live. So when the worst thing that can happen is not that bad, then you should give it a try.
So one of my last questions now goes to you as an experienced mother of three girls, right? So what is actually your central advice to them in terms of female empowerment? What do you teach them? What do you tell them in order to be able to struggle with everything that they could confront?
Well, I think they have had the very strong encouragement also from their father to really make an effort to do the best with the things that where they find they have a talent and to develop a passion for what they do. Because if you're passionate about something, then that will inspire other people and they will see, oh, she really wants to do this. Because that joy of learning, that joy of doing things that comes with passion, that is probably one of the most important things that you can give to your kids, that they see that this is important for someone and it can be so many different things.
Well, Mrs. Vestager, that was very, very interesting. Let me thank you very much for this wonderful and interesting conversation. I would really love to go on, but time is running quickly, and we have to stop here, unfortunately. So it was great having you here, but now we have to say goodbye. Thank you very, very much for having been our guest, and congratulations again for winning the prize. And now have a good day. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And thank you for this wonderful interview and, of course, the prize. Thanks a lot.
Das war die Verleihung des Marion-Dönhoff-Preises für internationale Verständigung und Versöhnung an Margrethe Vestager mit einer Laudatio der Präsidentin der Europäischen Zentralbank Christine Lagarde und einem Gespräch meiner Kollegin Iliana Grabitz mit der Preisträgerin. Weitere Gespräche, wie etwa solche meiner Kollegin Charlotte Parnak mit mir, mit Politikern und andere Interviews von Zeitredakteurinnen und Redakteuren mit Gästen, finden Sie unter www.zeit.de/zeitbühne. Mein Name ist Roman Plätter, ich bin stellvertretender Leiter des Wirtschaftsressorts der Zeit und ich freue mich auf das nächste Mal mit Ihnen und Zeitbühne. Danke fürs Zuhören, bleiben Sie uns gewogen und vor allem bleiben Sie gesund.